home so you can answer it, ask your question, and that he may answer it, and we'll get it all on tape. So, Dr. Clark, we turn it over to you.
First of all, these questions that have been given to me in written form. There are three on this card. One I can answer in one word. That will save time. The first question is, in the utility of creation, its origination, its progression and final consummation, is there any greater revelation than that of Revelation 4:11 and Romans 1:20? Now, I am not sure what the person means by the utility of creation, but I would suppose that if you wish to pick out some passage of the Bible that has a tremendous importance and is most indispensable, I would not choose Romans 1:20 nor Revelation 4:11. I would choose Romans 3, 20 to 26. I think those verses contain more of the biblical truth than any other half dozen verses in all the Bible. But maybe that is not what the person meant by the question. The second question he asks is there any adequate revelation for the purpose of creation outside the Bible? I answer that in one word, no. Then what happens after the final consummation of all creation? That might take a long time to answer, but I could mention one or two things. All marriages are dissolved. We become as the angels of heaven. Food and stomach disappear, and we enjoy theology for eternity. That's a partial answer, of course. Now then, here are two questions. Yes, oh, well, here comes some more. What propositions do you try to get across when you present or preach the gospel? Well, first of all, I would say that the whole Bible is the gospel, not just a little part of it. And I do not like to reduce its scope and center only on some pet subject. I do, however, recognize that there are things that must be emphasized more than others. And that's what I said just a moment ago, that the doctrine of the propitiatory sacrifice or the satisfaction view of the atonement is one thing I most certainly try to get across, but I also try to follow Paul's advice to preach the whole counsel of God in order not to be guilty of the blood of men. I think we must preach the whole counsel, and this distinction between kerygma and church doctrine, as the Neo-Orthodox put it, I have no sympathy with that. Now, the second question here, would you venture a rendering of Acts 1:3 that would help clear the cobwebs of empiricism from our minds? No. I have already done it several times over. But I realize, of course, that when a person who has, and I say this with at least a little humility, when a person has studied a subject for a relatively long period of time, so far as human life is concerned, and he has a lot of details in his mind, then when he talks to other people, students, for example, who have not had the opportunity of 80 or 90 years, because, you know, I'm a senile person that gives superfluous lectures, it takes time for all this to sink in. And it doesn't surprise me in the least that there are cobwebs of empiricism in person's mind, and it requires thinking, meditation, consideration. It isn't something that you can grasp in a day or two, and I have repeated a number of times the problem which I challenge empiricists to answer, the problem first of showing how you can get from a pure sensation, if there is such a thing, to perception, and then the problem of educated people having no images and so on, which to my mind are destructive of empiricism, but which a great many people haven't thought about so much. And so it takes time and makes a discussion. Now then, in your reference to Saul's or Paul's understanding, in reference to Saul's understanding before his conversion, please explain what you mean as to what degree Paul understood. I guess you mean what proposition Saul understood. Well, I think the main proposition that troubled the Apostle Paul was that he realized that Jesus claimed to be God. And for him, this was blasphemy. Now, he understood more, too, no doubt. But the chief proposition that angered him was that a mere human being claimed to be God. That's a short answer to that question. Now, I'll wait this time. Will you please expound James 1, 13 and 14, where it says that no one is tempted to sin by God. God tempts no one. How does this fit into what you have said this evening? And I think that question is, at least it overlaps the two on this sheet, but I'll answer first. The cause, or the responsible cause of an action, is always the immediate cause and not the remote causes. The remote causes are, one of the remote causes of sin, of course, is Adam's sin, by which we become sinners. But the immediate cause of sin is ourselves. It is we who will to sin. I think the Bible makes it fairly clear that we cannot escape responsibility by saying that we inherited the sin of Adam. In fact, this makes our own sin worse. In the case of David that I referred to a little while ago, David doesn't say, I committed a terrible sin, but after all, I was born in sin and I couldn't help it. What he says was, I committed a horrible sin, and what was worse, I was born that way. This reference to something more ultimate does not relieve a person of responsibility. If anything, it makes the situation worse. Now, this leads to the question that I have here. Why is man held responsible for his sin? And what is your definition of responsibility? I just love definitions, if I can ever get them, because you ought to know what the words mean if you use them. And if you use a word ambiguously, you're sure to become confused. And we ought to define responsibility and what the basis of responsibility is. Now, responsibility, etymologically, and I think philosophically too, means to be answerable. You give an answer to somebody. This is responsibility. And we are answerable to God because God demands an answer from us. That is why we are responsible. Now, in addition to this general principle, which governs the rest of the situation, the Bible teaches, I believe the Bible teaches, that there are degrees of responsibility. because the servant who knew his Lord's will and did not do it was beaten with many stripes, but the servant who did not know his will was beaten, but not beaten with many stripes. And Jesus, in his reply to Pilate, said the people who delivered him had the greater sin than Pilate had. So there are degrees of heinousness in sin. These degrees depend on the degree of knowledge that a person has. The more knowledge a person has, the more responsible he is. And so God assigns degrees of responsibility on the basis of how much a man knows. No man, as the Bible puts it, is utterly ignorant, though, as I say, some people asymptotically approach it. But no man is absolutely ignorant, and therefore all men are at least minimally responsible. But men in high places and people who have studied are more responsible than other people. It is a great responsibility to be a minister, for example. A minister presumably knows more about the Bible than most other people, and the more you know, the more responsible you are. Now, a responsibility then is, to define it, is to be answerable to a superior power. Now, this also means that although God is the cause of all sin, God is not responsible, because there is no higher power to demand an answer of him. So responsibility is a characteristic of people to whom divine commandments have been given. But there are no commandments imposed on God by any superior power, for there is no superior power. This is briefly my interpretation of responsibility and why a person is responsible for his sin. God decided to hold a man in certain degrees responsible, degrees corresponding to the degrees of his knowledge. Now, other people no doubt wish to follow this up and ask other questions. This is all that has been presented to me in writing. Yes, over here.
Yes, I'd like to ask you with regard to the fall of Adam. I understand, I think, that you would assert that God caused Adam to fall.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now,
if he had not, his whole plan of salvation would have been shattered at the beginning.
Well, I'm not against you.
Right. I certainly try to add a detail once in a while.
Okay. It's my understanding also that St. Augustine, Luther, and Calvin, and the majority of Reformed men did not assert that. They asserted that he had free will, and it's my understanding, too, that such scholars such as Roger Nicol and others have sort of castigated you for being outside of Reformed tradition. Now, I've been thinking a lot about this because I hold your position. How do you feel about what these men thought about this area? They seem to me to be contradictory, but I'm your study of them.
I have a little question as to the accuracy of the statements you present as factual. It is true that St. Augustine, early in his life, before he had matured as a Christian, although he denied free will for us sinners, allowed that Adam had free will before the fall. But this was written in an early work of his, and it is retracted in his later works. I would like you to read the De Praedestinonia Sanctorum, and there's another one, something about grace or the gospel. I forget the title just now.
Do you remember where that is in that work?
Oh, do it.
It's not a long work.
No, it's not a long work. It's It's not 420 pages of double columns like the City of God.
My specific question with regard to these men is I do not ever remember hearing the phrase by Augustine, Luther, or the others that God created evil.
Well, I thought your statement was that Augustine, Luther, and Calvin supported free will.
Well, this is a question along with that.
Martin Luther wrote a big, thick book denying free will. So, and as for Calvin, I recommend that you read Book 3, Chapter 23, which came up in a discussion earlier today.
My point is, Adam before the fall. It's my understanding that Augustine and his followers did not believe that Adam, or they did believe Adam had a free will before the fall.
Augustine, in his early work, De Libero Arbitrio, held just what you say. But in his later work, he retracted it.
Do you feel like this is, then do you disagree with those that would say you're outside of the Reformed tradition? In other words, it seems that they assert that this is not in the major confessions.
On this point, I would talk about the confessions in a minute. On this point, I rather have the opinion that I agree with Augustine's later point of view, with Luther's bondage of the will, and with Calvin's position too. And I don't see how you can make it plainer than in Book 3, Chapter 23, but there are other places in Calvin too.
So with regard to Adam before the fall?
Oh, yes, universally, okay. Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Then my next question is this. What is the difference? Last question. What is the difference between Adam's will before the fall and Adam's will after the fall, if they're both
so far as being determined by God's decree, there is no difference whatever.
What is the difference? Any difference at all?
Well, the difference is that before the fall, God determined him to think good thoughts, and at and after the fall, God determines him to think some evil thoughts.
So you would disagree with those who castigate you and put you outside of the Reformed, but you think you're right in line with the Reformers?
I hardly think that's what Roger Nicol says. But anyhow, if he says it, I would respectfully disagree. Roger Nicol is one of the best theologians in all the United States, if not in the world. He is a tremendously learned man.
Dr. Clark, you made a statement in your lecture tonight about a certain football player who weighed twice as much as his IQ, and we have a football player up here on the front pew here. He has been all pro for quite a few years, and he says he would like to take you on afterwards.
And my question is your predestination in the parking lot after you talk.
What did he say?
He said that it was predestined that you meet him in the parking lot afterwards.
I'll challenge you at a game of chess.
Would like for some of you who have not asked questions to feel free to ask them. I realize the questions are being monopolized by some. Feel free, but if you'd like for some of the other ones to feel
monopolized. Is that what we call the convicting work of the Holy Spirit? Dr. Clark, I have a question I think that many might be asking, and that is, in light of your comments that God is the cause of sin, I think that many would object, and I've heard some object, that this is destructive of any form of ethical system whereby God would we would say, judiciously reward or punish an individual for doing something concerning which he had no, I don't want to put it, choice, or concerning which he was foreordained to do from eternity past. And how would you respond to this and the whole question of commands and the judicial character of rewards and punishments?
Well, in the first place, I might ask, and it may take me a half an hour to give the first paragraph of the answer, I might first ask, how could you have moral responsibility if you had free will? If a person decides something without any cause or reason at all, perfectly indeterminate, I would think that that person is insane and hence not responsible. It is only through a theory of determinism that you can have moral responsibility. Now, we are responsible in the degree in which we know. The knowledge is involved. As Charles Hodge says, the intellect totally controls the will. But according to indeterminism, the will is completely undetermined by anything. How a person can say that if you accept determinism, you cannot have ethical norms, that is a statement for which I would want an argument. And I think I could easily show many difficulties in any argument that led to that conclusion. Maybe that's not a good enough answer, but that would be the beginning of it. And you asked something else, slightly different. What was it?
How would you explain that God judiciously rewards and punishes?
I think you mean judicially, don't you?
Those actions which are foreordained for eternity, which could not have been otherwise than that they were.
How could God judiciously have foreordained certain actions? Well, just the way he created the world. He decided to give elephants trunks and legs, thick ones. He gave a wren only two legs, very thin.
I think he does mean judicially instead of judiciously.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand what you meant.
Judicially. Well, the rules of moral law, are those imposed by God. And God imposes the laws as he pleases. The law then becomes the judicial basis for condemnation. If a person breaks the law, then the law is the judicial basis for his condemnation. This is part of God's decree. It's all the same decree, but with many details. Now, let me see. When something passed through my mind on this. Now, too many ideas go, and I can't recall them too well. But sin is a violation or a lack of conformity unto the law of God. So he establishes the ground on which he will condemn people. That's the judicial position, yes.
A new question.
I heard the comment made a number of times since my exposure to Calvinism about 5 years ago that a higher good was accomplished as a result of God allowing salvation to come through Christ after the fall. Usually I've heard it just said, it just accomplished, it permits a higher good to take place if you take a look at the fall in terms of something that happened in history. Okay, my question is, since man was in a sinless state, even though he had the potential for sin, prior to the fall, and no condemnation was evidenced on mankind at that point in time, then why is it that God would permit the fall to allow that higher good, when in reality, if he had not permitted the fall, condemnation would not have come upon men? Why is it a higher good for salvation to take place as a result of sin destroying the relationship of man, when actually prior to the fall, no such salvation would have been necessary? If I'm correct in assuming that no salvation was necessary.
In the first place, I do not accept the statement that God permitted the fall. God caused the fall. Permission is an idea that is incongruous with omnipotence and sovereignty. And Calvin is very clear that permission plays no part in Calvinistic theology. Then I think maybe that is the basic answer to your question. But something else I might want to say that I just thought of again in answer to the other question. When I say that God controls the will and choice of man, I do not deny volition and choice. In fact, I assert it. But I do not assert that man is equally able to make either of two contradictory choices. He makes the choice that God has determined that he should make. And that is really essential to the doctrine of salvation and faith, because man is, in his sinful estate, is utterly unwilling to accept the divine gospel, and hence his mind must be changed. So God makes a man willing. His willingness is determined. It is not a matter of something that he does apart from God. If somebody comes up to the aisle and wants to shake the hands of the evangelist, which of course doesn't do him any good anyhow, if anything happens, it's God that makes it happen. I do not agree that God is impotent and that there is no use praying to him. God converts people, regenerates them, and gives them the gift of faith. This is determined by God. It's not a matter of free will at all.
Dr. Clark, in Calvin's Institutes, in the first book, he argues that when God moves a man's will, he does it in this manner, that God wills to have an action take place, and therefore when he wants to have a sinful action take place, that he wills that a sinful man act, and then the sinful man, when he acts because his will is bent toward sin, acts in sin. Now, somewhere in your lecture, you threw out a sentence that made me wonder if you're agreeing with Calvin or if you are leaving out the step of God willing the man's will to move and just simply saying, man, sin.
No, I think I said considerably more than that. It is not that God says, well, commit some sin, you think it up, I don't care which. I gave you the precise example of Absalom, Hushai, and Ahithophel. And God made Absalom commit this one particular sin because no other sin in that situation would have accomplished what God wanted to accomplish. And the sin was to accept the bad military counsel of Hushai instead of the perfectly good military council of Ahithophel.
Do you agree with Calvin then, or in the, shall we say, the mechanism in which that takes place, where God causes a man's will to move and then the man, because he is sinful, accent.
I am not conscious of any disagreement with Calvin on that point at any rate.
Thank you.
Just a couple of more questions, because I know that some of you have to go, but here's one. Maybe it's
I'm inquiring about the difference between infra and supralapsarianism. In Warfield's book, he defines infra and supra as being a difference in the order of decrees, but he does not go into the nature of what this order is well enough. He says it's not temporal. He says a logical order. But would it be more fruitful, and I'd like your definition after this last comment, would it be more fruitful to say that the infra brings the sin in by mysteriously bringing this idea of permission instead of action, whereas the supra says they are both directly activated?
The idea of permission has been invented by some people who wish to avoid saying that God is the ultimate cause of sin. They want to save God's holiness against objections. The trouble is that the notion of permission does not do what these people want done, because God would still be, responsible. He would still have his holiness questioned if he permitted something that he could have stopped. If there is a situation in human life where, a child is about to be run over by a car, and it is possible for a bystander to run out and save him, and the bystander permits the auto to hit him, this is not very happy either. So permission does not solve the Arminian's problem. And as I said before, Calvin expressly repudiates permission.
What is the difference between infra and supra?
The difference is that infralapsarianism puts the decree of election subsequent to the decree of the fall. Now, someone at lunch had a different notion of infralapsarianism, but if you wish to check various theologians, you can look up Henry Bradford Smith, Louis Burkhoff, my father, and maybe Charles Hodge, and I think you will find in all of them that they put the decree of election after the decree of the fall. My criticism of this is that they confuse logical sequence with temporal sequence. And my contention is that the logical sequence is precisely the reverse of the temporal sequence. A person chooses an end and then works back from the end to where he is now on something that he can do. At lunch, I used this illustration. If you wish to buy your wife a little present, a box of candy or a scarf or this kind of thing, you want to buy a gift for her, and you decide on a box of candy. That's the beginning of it. Now you say, how can I get a box of candy to give her? Well, you have to think where a candy store is. And then when you decide where the candy store is, you have to say, well, how do I get there? You may drive or take a bus or something. And then how are you going to buy the candy? Well, you need some money. And so that is the way you think. You begin at the end and think back to where you are. That's the logical order. Now, the temporal order is exactly the reverse. You put some money in your pocket, you take the bus, you go to the store and get the candy. Now, in the case of lapsarianism, We have the temporal order given in the scriptures quite clearly. You begin at Genesis and go through. Now then, if you wish to talk about the logical order of the decrees, you just reverse that. I hope that meets your question.
Dr. Clark has further discussion of it in the last chapter of his of the Festschrift, edited by Ronald Nash, in his reply to Roger Nicole, including a similar illustration. Now, there was a question down here, I understand.
Thank you. Dr. Clark, I'll start out by stating that I would concur in the question or the position that I was about to place before you, and the question was has already really been presented in a way. But I was interested in your view or comments upon the position of the septolapsarian, and not just to ask a question in particular, but rather some brief comment that you might we might have time for. That is to say that in this discussion, the idea of perhaps the essence of the septolapsarian position being found in the providence of God, in that while he did elect, he not only elected to life, but he elected to destruction, and that hence it was naturally then preceding the other decrees, and principally that of the fall itself, or that he did elect without consequence or consideration to sin and the eventual fall of man. Would you mind commenting on that, please?
Well, I would say that the eternal decree of God embraces every event that takes place in the whole history of the world. But there are some events which attract our attention more than others. And the Dukes of Edom are not quite so important as the doctrine of election or reprobation or the glory of God or justification and so on. And hence, this matter of the logical order of the decrees is usually limited to a small number of very important points. But you could expand it, of course, to take in all the minor details. And since God acts for a purpose, to get the logical order, you need to state the purpose first, and then the means by which he accomplishes that purpose. I think that is the key to this problem. Is that a sufficient, or at least half-sufficient answer to your question?
Dr. Clark, in behalf of a number of people here who are visiting Believer's Chapel and who will not be here in the morning, I want to say for all of us, including them, we do appreciate very much your being with us.
Let me express my thanks for your kind invitation. I enjoyed it all more than you did.
Thank you.